Some people don't want oil and gas pipelines built on their land, but sometimes there isn't much they can do about it.
At every turn, the system has failed us. They've left us no choice.
I'm Carol Holsoppel. This week on the Allegheny Front, pipeline protesters go to new lengths to protect their property. And we get a lesson in tracking climate change from the birds and the bees.
Insects are basically a mobile weather station.
Plus, it's spring, and that can only mean one thing. It's eagle cam season.
Here she comes.
A reporter infiltrates the birds' fan following. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Pipeline companies are busy building new routes for oil and gas in Pennsylvania. But around the state, hundreds of landowners are fighting to keep these companies off their land. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports about one family in central Pennsylvania trying, without success, to prevent a pipeline from crossing their property.
In January, a judge in Huntington County ruled that Sunoco Logistics could use eminent domain to build a pipeline through woods owned by the Gerhardt family. This week, a chainsaw crew came to the family's property to cut trees on the right-of-way. Elise Gerhardt grew up there, and along with her parents, had tried for months to fight the pipeline. But the law was not on their side, and as the chainsaws arrived, Elise climbed a tree on the property to protest the tree clearing.
At every turn, the system has failed us. They've left us no choice. No one's coming to protect us.
The family is appealing the eminent domain decision. A company spokesman said the crews were there legally. Trying to meet a March 31st deadline for tree clearing meant to protect migratory birds and an endangered bat. Sunoco's Mariner East 2 pipeline will take propane, ethane, and butane, which can be used for fuel or to make plastics, across Pennsylvania to an industrial complex in Philadelphia. Elise's mother, Ellen, said the family had signed an agreement with the state to keep the land forested, but that agreement couldn't keep the chainsaws away.
You know, our little part that we thought we could do some good in by...
She watched as a crew took down a large tree.
By at least protecting 3 acres of Pennsylvania.
That was her on Tuesday. The next day, she was arrested for being on the right-of-way, though she was released later that day. In the end, all but a dozen trees were taken down. Work on the pipeline is expected to start this summer. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Political fallout continues over Pennsylvania's long-delayed state budget. But when Governor Tom Wolf allowed it to pass, it ensured that public schools and other programs had the money to keep their doors open. Among those spared the budget acts, a century-old program to help farmers and communities throughout the state. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant explains what the money pays for.
Rick Rausch worried he was going to spend April preparing pink slips.
We were very seriously facing having to send out layoff notices to at least 1,100 employees on the 1st of May.
Rausch is dean of the Penn State Agricultural Extension. His program has farming experts and researchers in each of the state's 67 counties.
I have to say we were very worried, and the worry was shared at the highest levels of administration and the university.
Penn State's Ag Extension was started in the early 1900s. The idea was to bring science to farming. Today, their agents work with 92,000 kids in 4-H programs, with communities on food, health, and environmental issues, and with Pennsylvania's 33,000 farmers on everything from reducing chemical runoff into waterways, managing habitat for wildlife, and identifying threats to the state's $140 million fruit industry.
Because a big part of what the college and extension do is to look at invasive pests. Because we're in every county, we have people on the ground spread out across the state, and they're often the first detectors of a new invasive pest species or blight or anything like that.
Rausch says if they had started laying people off, there was a real risk the whole ag extension system would fall apart. The state's $50 million investment in the program, along with money from the counties, levies millions in federal grants.
That would have been something like 78 $80 million a year that's federal tax money that would have been coming back to Pennsylvania to address our problems. So there was a lot of money on the table that really hinged on the state government funding as our core.
Roush's neighboring states are increasing investments in agriculture. Ohio State University, for one, has committed $100 million in an effort to transform the food system.
We look with envy at what's happening in Ohio and New York and other places across the country, is that they're increasingly being able to build on this vision of a more sustainable agricultural future, one that's climate change adapted, one that's reducing greenhouse gas emissions, all those kinds of things we want to do as well. But they're in a position where they can act on it because they've got the resources and can really take it to the field in a stronger way than we can.
Instead of new investments like this, Roush says he's looking at Pennsylvania's $2 billion budget deficit and still worries about holding on to his current people and programs. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Well, that $100 million investment that Ohio State University is making in agriculture is called the Initiative for Food and Agricultural Transformation, the INFACT program. In fact, they've tapped someone we've heard from in the past to run the program, Brian Snyder. He's been the executive director of the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture for 15 years. I recently talked with Snyder by phone about his new gig, which begins in June. I started by asking him, what's the goal of the program?
Well, this is a program that actually started up a couple of years ago over at Ohio State University. They're trying to work across the whole university, across all schools and departments, to not only raise awareness about the importance of food systems and food security, but to actually do something about it. And it also is aimed at conducting outreach beyond the university to get other nonprofit groups and churches and other businesses and farmers, consumers, all kind of working on the same idea of improving food security. They impressed upon me the fact that they want to find solutions that will have an impact not only right there in the community that they serve in Columbus and throughout Ohio, but they'd like to set an example for other schools and other areas of the country that are trying to address similar issues.
And why have you decided to make this move?
Well, you know, my work here at PASA, it's been a real pleasure for me to work on food systems in Pennsylvania, working across a number of different levels of the food system. And so in many ways, this is a similar kind of job, only it is going to occur inside the university rather than independently in a nonprofit. And so I'm kind of intrigued by two aspects of this job. One is that there are far more resources available in the university to do this kind of work. And I'm very interested to see if we can get, you know, those resources all kind of moving in the same direction. And secondly, I'm just really concerned about the land grant system generally across the country and how the mission is being met or not met. And I was very impressed to find that folks at Ohio State are taking that question very seriously, too, and wanting to see how they can improve.
Could you elaborate on that and say a little bit more about what the land grant program is?
You know, we're all familiar with the work that land grants do through extension and teaching programs and research. It's very familiar. But sometimes that work doesn't get all the way down to the ground and affects some of the people that are most vulnerable in terms of their food systems. And on that score, I would say, you know, that I would include both farmers that are struggling to make ends meet, often not being paid what their work is worth through the price of food. And then, of course, we have the sort of the opposite problem, or at the other end of the spectrum, communities that are not able to access the kind of nutrition that they need to keep their families healthy and even the economies of communities strong. And I think that there's a lot that sustainable agriculture has to offer in both of those cases and for a lot of situations that fall in between. And that universities, particularly those with a lot of resources, can do a lot to address these kinds of issues.
I read that President Michael Drake of Ohio State University has committed a minimum of $100 million over the next 10 years to this program. Are there obstacles in getting this type of commitment to sustainable agriculture at this level in Pennsylvania?
Well, there certainly are obstacles, and I've spent the last 15 years trying to address some of those. I'm happy to report that I think we've made a lot of progress, but there continue to be issues that have to be addressed. I mean, the Chesapeake Bay watershed, and certainly the conflicts that occur in an area as diverse as what the Chesapeake Bay watershed defines, are really critical, not only here but elsewhere. And the barriers are that we see farms and farmers that are trying to make the right decisions and struggle to keep their farms viable so that the land doesn't become developed in the future in other ways. And at the same time, as we know, farming is sometimes hard on the land. Now, enter into that the fact that we know that there are ways in which farming can actually improve the land. We can actually improve soil quality. We can actually improve water quality. We can sequester carbon. And so, you know, when you understand that, it really makes it worthwhile to work through some of the barriers that come up. Government policy sometimes is a barrier, and I'm very glad to see in recent years that, you know, the Pennsylvania state government and the Department of Agriculture in particular understands the role of government in helping farms to make better choices. And they're taking some leadership in wanting to restore the health of the bay. So, you know, these are all problems that do have solutions, but they require a long-term point of view and a long-term strategy, and that might be the biggest barrier. People often want short-term solutions. You know, we didn't get here into some of the environmental problems that we have in short order. They're not going to go away in a short amount of time either. Short-term thinking in general is probably the biggest barrier that we face in trying to repair food systems, you know, both for the farmers and for the consumers, and even for the environment, too.
Brian Snyder is the executive director of the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, and he will be heading up Ohio State University's InFact program, which promotes agriculture. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Wildlife watchers love bald eagles. They're beautiful. They're majestic.
They're killing machines. That's all they do is reproduce and kill. That's all they're meant to be.
Well, they do have really cuddly looking babies. Later on the Allegheny Front, we visit a community that sprung up near an eagle's nest in Pittsburgh. You might want to get out your binoculars and stay tuned. Up before dawn, working in the fields, feeding the cows, that's the reality of a farmer's life. But farming is still thought of as a male-dominated field. Thousands of women farmers across the country are often left in the shadows. Harvest Public Media's Suzanne Hogan met up with women farmers looking for some more support to give their businesses an edge.
Ever since Aubrey Fletcher was a little girl, she knew she wanted to work on a dairy farm.
I do remember my mom asking, "Are you sure this is what you want to do?"
Fletcher says she knew the work was hard. She grew up milking cows every day. Now she and her husband's family run Edgewood Creamery outside of Springfield, Missouri, and she loves it. Inside the barn, Fletcher shows me the newest additions to the herd, a few calves who were born earlier in the week. Using her fingers, she teaches the young heifers how to get used to using a bottle.
It takes them a little bit, but it doesn't take them long. They're quick learners.
And as we drive the small work truck to check out the older cows in the pasture, Fletcher tells me their dairy is expecting 300 more calves this year. That will add an extra load to an already busy schedule between milkings, feedings, and fixing things that need fixing.
There's always something to be done on the farm, and very rarely my house gets cleaned, so.
In the United States, a third of farms are run by couples like the Fletchers, sharing the workload and daily responsibilities. And in the past 15 years, the fraction of women who are taking the lead on the farms has nearly tripled. Now it's about 15%. Fletcher meets regularly with a new group of women dairy farmers, and she says having a space to come together with other women has been huge.
Because they can relate to you. They understand, oh, you had three calves this morning and, you know, you didn't get your kids to school on time. You know, they understand the struggles of being a dairy farm wife slash mom. And it's easy to just talk to them about the struggles of a dairy farm and talk about the good times.
And it's not just about the social and emotional support. Education has been the main component. Reagan Bluehl is a dairy specialist for the University of Missouri Extension. We talked on Skype. She runs the group of women dairy farmers.
This is another forum to gather information both from Extension, but also from their peers to see what is successful on those farms.
Bluehl says the daily grind of agricultural work can make it hard for farmers to get off the farm. But they've been making the time, the first Monday every other month.
365 days a year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It can be very isolating. And so sometimes it takes scheduling yourself to leave the farm.
Bluehl polled the women to find out what they want to learn about. And in the next few months, she'll program sessions about everything from calf raising to stress management.
They've been through the ups and downs of the milk price, and they see how knowledge can then translate to successes within their herd.
Many women are used to standing out at big farm shows or meetings. And that's why Rebecca Conley started a group for women in dairy in Pennsylvania.
Women on farms has always been there. It's just now women are looking for more information off the farm.
Conley says that women want more training. They're seeking out more entrepreneurial opportunities, like starting a creamery. They're trying to bring a competitive edge to their farm. What she's hearing from her group?
Work-home balance was a big one, and also value-added products.
Which is something Aubrey Fletcher back at Edgewood Creamery can relate to. The idea to start their creamery came from her and her husband's desire to return to his family farm.
The farm couldn't necessarily provide both of us with salaries, and so we thought, why not take our premium milk and take that a little further?
A year in, Fletcher says the creamery is helping the dairy stay afloat. They just opened a small storefront on the farm, selling their milk and cheese. And she and her husband are building the business and the life they wanted. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
Harvest Public Media is a public radio collaboration that reports on food and agriculture issues in the Midwest. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapel. Show us your spring. That's a special seasonal request from our partners at icchange.org, the crowdsourced climate and weather almanac. People just like you log in to icchange to share comments, questions, and sometimes concerns about what they're seeing outside. Over the last few weeks, we've seen some interesting things on the site. Early magnolia blossoms, rose pruning in March, unexpected warm weather. Now icchange.org is upping the ante. They want you to pick a spot in your backyard, or maybe a favorite tree or a roadside garden that's on your way to work. Post a photo of it at icchange, then come back the next week and do it again. What changes or patterns will we notice over time? Go to icchange, that's I-S-E-E, change.org, to find out. Now, the other part of icchange is getting experts to weigh in on what we're seeing. That's where Dan Herms comes in. He's a researcher at Ohio State University who looks at how insects interact with woody plants, like in orchards or ornamental gardens, and how weather and climate affect and sometimes disrupt plants and insect cycles. Dr. Herms, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Some people have posted comments or questions on icchange.org about seeing an unusual bug in their garden or noticing flowers from a tree. Someone posted about apple trees blooming earlier in the spring and then producing fruit earlier. But a lot of times we don't or can't connect the dots with weather and then, of course, the larger picture of climate. But you do study the cycles and the seasonal nature of plants and animals, insects, you're an entomologist, and climate. So, and that's called phenology. So first, can you explain the concept of phenology? Kind of give us a phenology 101.
Sure. Phenology is the study of reoccurring biological events, like when things flower, migration times of animals, breeding times, when insects emerge, these kind of things that occur on a regular basis from one year to the next. It's been called the oldest science because the existence of humans, of course, is very tightly linked to phenology, planting season, birthing season of animals.
I was going to say, this is nothing new, and we were thinking about the Old Farmer's Almanac, but it goes back a lot further than that.
Goes back eons.
In your research, you use it as a predictor for when certain insects may be visiting our area.
The development time of insects is completely dependent on the temperature, and so they develop faster in warm springs and summers and slower in cool springs. And so insects are basically a mobile weather station. And if you track the weather, you can predict very accurately when certain insects will appear or when plants will bloom.
So could you give me an example of an insect plant phenology from our region?
One of my favorite plants for monitoring phenology is a native shrub or small tree that's in the forest called the serviceberry. Serviceberry blooms around here in mid-April, and they call it serviceberry because the timing of its blooming corresponded when the pioneers would have funeral services for people that died during the winter, because the ground was now thawed enough to bury the people that had passed away during the winter. It's also called Juneberry because the flowers develop in June, and it's also called shadbush because at the time that the flowers bloom, the shad run up the streams from the Great Lakes to spawn.
So it's got a lot of connections with a lot of phenomena that are happening at the same time that are weather-related.
Right. It certainly does.
How can a changing climate or global warming, a warming climate, what are some of the ways it can affect plant and insect phenology?
Well, as the climate warms and as the spring warms, plants and insects develop faster and emerge sooner. So that's one thing. And as an example, we have a spectacular crabapple display here on campus. And it was always said that come on Mother's Day weekend, if you want to see the crabapples bloom. Well, now the crabapples generally bloom a couple weeks before Mother's Day. And we tell people to come the last week of April if you want to see those bloom. Another change is in the distribution of insects. And so as the temperatures get warmer, insects that formerly could not survive in a particular area because it was too cold are moving into that area.
I wanted to know if there were other implications for climate change and phenology. I understand that phenology is sort of chronological in that the order doesn't necessarily change. For example, the tree flowers and the insect shows up so many, days later. Does climate change have any impact on that chronological cycle?
There has been documented what we call phenological asynchrony. And one example could be bird migrations. So as the birds come back in the wintertime, they're not responding to the climate here. They're responding to cues on their overwintering ground. And when they get here, they can find that the insects that they're used to feeding on have already completed development, for example. And in some Arctic birds, it's already been shown that their breeding has been disrupted because of this kind of phenological mismatch between their migration time and the abundance of their food.
What is maybe since you've been looking at this so long, you've been looking at the data so long, what is the biggest change that you've seen?
Just kind of this general change of how, much earlier things are blooming in Michigan, not only in my data, but also, when we rake the leaves. It used to be by Halloween all the leaves were down. Now Thanksgiving and the oak leaves still aren't down. So the change has been pretty dramatic if you pay attention.
And this is something that worries you.
It does, because, the thing is that organisms and humans tend to be adapted to the climate that they have experienced over the long term. And, when that changes, it's going to require that organisms, including us humans, adapt to the new reality, and we're going to have to.
Thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Dan Herms is an entomologist at Ohio State University. You can learn more about his work and our partnership with icchange.org, the online almanac, at our website, alleghenyfront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. And now we're going to talk about eagle fever. It's gripping cities in the Northeast right now. Eaglets hatched recently on a live web stream in Washington, D.C., and people fell in love with them. They're also watching webcams in Hanover, Pennsylvania, and in Pittsburgh, where bald eagles have nested for the last few years after a 200-year hiatus because of polluted rivers. That pair laid 3 eggs, and so far, 2 have hatched. In Pittsburgh, WESA's Sarah Schneider reports from a riverfront trail where you can see the nest.
Eagles are nesting a few miles from downtown Pittsburgh. People who started as strangers there have become friends, spending every weekend on the trail about 600 feet from the nest, staring up. They bring lawn chairs and telephoto camera lenses. Some wear binoculars, others are clad in camouflage, waiting for the birds to fly.
Now she's going to get ready to go.
Get ready for a fly.
Here she comes.
Joggers and cyclists stop and ask what everyone is looking at. And that's when the regulars show off their knowledge. How the male and female switch off egg guarding duty, what kind of fish they bring back to the nest, how they roll the eggs to keep a steady temperature, and that the nest is the size of a queen mattress.
Yeah, they're killing machines. That's all they do is reproduce and kill. That's all they're meant to be.
That's Dan Desenich. He's watching the live stream of the nest on his phone, ready with his camera for the birds to take flight. When another regular, Wendy Merrill, shows up, Dan hugs her. The friends met on the trail watching the birds. She's also become an avid eagle watcher since the birds came back to the city. She's a clinical psychologist and says she enjoys studying the birds' social patterns.
You know, it wasn't very long ago that the only people who ever got to see inside an eagle's nest were an elite small group of researchers.
Via the webcam, Merrill and others get much closer than they can in person, watching run-ins with intruders and hearing the eagles' calls. The webcam drew most of these people to the trail. When the eagles are in the nest, they consult the live stream on their phones, checking the status of the chicks.
And that was kind of high.
That was a high flyout.
You could knock them out in the air with a clothespin.
Yes, yes. And just seeing that wingspan and that grimace they have coming right at you is incredible.
The eaglets should fly on their own in 2 to 3 months, but there's no way of knowing where they'll end up. If they do make it in 4 to 5 years, they could lay eggs of their own.
If they're not sleeping, they're eating.
Thanks to Sarah Schneider of WESA in Pittsburgh for putting together that audio postcard. If you're out on the trail this weekend and you see an eagle or another bird of note, you can tweet it to us. We're at Allegheny Front. Just don't get too close. Federal law prohibits people from intruding on a 660-foot perimeter around a bald eagle nest. Really, give them some space. We've got more about eagles and their irresistible babies at our website. That's AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.